Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, and I offer you my greetings and my salams. Malik. Before I begin, I would like to thank Princeton University, the Office of Religious Life, and the Muslim Program Office, and Chaplain Sohaib Sultan for inviting me here to speak today. It is a great pleasure for me to be among you. In the next half hour, I will speak about the sayings, sermons, and teachings of Imam Ali, the Islamic wisdom in which they are grounded, and the universal human values they espouse. I will focus on three aspects of Imam Ali's teachings: personal ethics, government and society, and mindfulness of the hereafter. I've discussed these themes in detail in academic publications, some out and some in press and forthcoming. In today's presentation, I will take a broader and more general approach. But first, a few minutes introducing Ali and his sayings and sermons. Imam Ali is an eminent figure in Islamic history. And many of you may know much of this already, so if, for those of you who do, please bear with me. I would like to introduce Ali for those who may not know his historical background. Cousin, son-in-law, and ward of the Prophet Muhammad, he was the first male to accept Islam. The Shia believe him to be the Prophet's legitimate successor in both his spiritual and temporal role. Sunnis regard him as the last of the four rightly guided caliphs. Both Shia and Sunni Muslims laud him for his deep personal loyalty to Muhammad, his valorous role in the early battles, and his profound piety, learning, and justice. They recount numerous hadith from the Prophet, hadith are the sayings of the Prophet, praising Ali. Among them, the most famous of which are, and I quote, "I am the city of knowledge, and Ali is its gateway." Another, "Ali is to me," this is the Prophet Muhammad speaking, sayings of the Prophet, "Ali is to me as Aaron was to Moses, except that there is no prophet after me." A third saying, "You, Ali, are my brother in this world and the next." Now, born in Mecca in around 600 AD, Ali was brought up by his older cousin Muhammad. 2 years after Muhammad's migration to Medina, he married the Prophet's youngest daughter, Fatima. Muhammad's line continued solely through Ali and Fatima's two sons, a line which would become an important locus for the Shia doctrine of the Imamate. In Medina, Ali participated actively in the setting up of the new polity, playing a key role in establishing Islam in its nascent stage. After Muhammad's death in 632 AD, Ali took a backseat in government during the reigns of the first three caliphs. 25 years later, in 656, he was thrust into the limelight when the community pledged allegiance to him as the new caliph. During the four short years of his reign, he fought three major battles against groups of Muslims who revolted against him, the most significant being the Battle of Siffin against the Syrians, led by the governor of Damascus, the Umayyad Muawiyah ibn Abi Sufyan. Ali had moved from Medina to Kufa. Kufa is near present-day Najaf in the south of Iraq. So Ali had moved from Medina to Kufa immediately after assuming the caliphate in order to intercept the first group of rebels. Thereafter, he remained in Iraq, occupied with the Syrian conflict. He spent his last few months unsuccessfully urging the Kufans to regroup and fight Muawiyah. In the year 661, Ali was killed by a Kharijite assassin while he was praying in the mosque in Kufa. Now, Imam Ali is widely acknowledged as a sage of Islamic wisdom, as a master of Arabic eloquence, and indeed as one of the most influential orators of Islam. When Abdul Hamid al-Katib, who has been called the father of Arabic prose, Abdul Hamid was a chancery official for the Umayyads, which is an interesting kind of connection. So when he was asked this question, what enabled you to master the science of eloquence? What formed your training in it? He replied, memorizing the words of Ali. When Muawiyah, after he took the caliphate, asked a companion of Ali named Dirar ibn Damra to describe the Imam, Dirar said, wisdom spoke upon his tongue. كانت الحكمة تنطق على لسانه. Now Ali's sayings, sermons, letters, and verse have had enormous currency through the ages and continue to resonate today. There are tens of collections in thousands of pages of Ali's compiled words. Among the earliest and best known extant compilations are The Path of Eloquence, Nahj al-Balagha, compiled by the Twelver Shiite scholar Ash-Sharif Arabi, who died in 1014. Another important compilation is A Treasury of Virtues that was just shown to you here. It's called Dustur Ma'alim al-Hikam in Arabic, and it was compiled by the Fatimid Shafi'i Sunni judge Al-Qadi Al-Qudai, who died in 1062. A third compilation is the 100 Proverbs, Mi'at Kalima, which is attributed to the collection of the Sunni Abbasid literature Al-Jahid, who died in 869. The latter two, the Treasury of Virtues and the Mi'at Kalima, the 100 Proverbs, I've edited and translated in this Library of Arabic Literature volume. I have just last week also completed an edition and a translation of a companion volume of the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad called Kitab al-Shihab in Arabic. It's coming out as A Light in the Heavens. And it was compiled by the same collector, Al-Qadi Al-Qudai. It's very similar in its framing, in its ethical and purview and its universal value setting as the material in the Treasury of Virtues. Now, again, just a couple of words about Ali's milieu in terms of the orality of his society and how that affected both his style and his output and the transmission of the material. So Ali lived in a largely oral society. And writing, though known, was infrequent and usually reserved for important documents and inscriptions. His orations and sayings, like those of others of his period, including the prophetic hadith and including orations by other early Islamic sages, were initially produced orally. And then, for the most part, they were transmitted by word of mouth over two or three generations. Only after the introduction of papermaking techniques to the Islamic world in the mid-8th century were they systematically transcribed in historical and literary books. The initial period of oral transmission meant that these materials were vulnerable to error or to fabrication. But scholarly findings of the last few decades about the nature of orality indicate that the strength of the indigenous Arabian tradition of oral transmission should not be underestimated. Ali was one of the most important and revered personages of early Islam. His eloquence was proverbial. And during the 4 years of his caliphate, he preached long and frequently to large public audiences. Thus, it is likely that the sayings and sermons attributed to Ali possess a genuine core, that a portion are authentic, some in essence, and some even verbatim. Growing up under Muhammad's care, Ali was continually exposed to the Quranic revelation. Consequently, his words are permeated by its vocabulary and themes. There is a religious flavor, a focus on piety, in all modes of Ali's speech, undergirding even the material produced in a political or military context. At the same time, his words also have a distinctly local flavor, a cultural texture grounded in the desert topography, tribal society, nomadic lifestyle, and rich poetic tradition of the Arabian Peninsula. In his verbal production, Quranic themes merge with nature imagery to produce a distinctive template of Islamic preaching, directives to contemplate the purpose of life and the majesty of the Creator, combined with the vocabulary and images of camel caravans, racing horses, and watering holes. Moreover, although rooted in a particular Islamic and Arabian context, Ali's words expound universal values and are applicable to the lives of humans in different times and places. His proverbial sayings were among the earliest pieces of Arabic literature with which the Western world engaged in the 17th and 18th century, presumably because of their universal ethical appeal. And now to the three categories of Ali's teachings that I said I would speak about: personal ethics, government and society, and mindfulness of the hereafter. So the first one is personal ethics. A prominent segment of Ali's oath is devoted to material that is ethical in nature. His sayings and sermons exhort you to be a morally upstanding human being. Often in the form of aphorisms or proverbs, they encourage such virtues as honesty, sincerity, and moderation, and warn against such vices as greed, oppression, and stinginess. I offer you a few samples from his humanitarian sayings. For most of these, I'll just read my English translation. For some, I'll throw in a little bit of the Arabic. I know that many in the audience do speak Arabic. For those who don't, I ask you to listen for the music of and the rhythm of the Arabic. I'll keep it to a minimum, but I do want you to get a sense of how it sounds in the original. So the following sayings showcase some of Ali's favored themes, as well as his pithy eloquence. Okay. The best words are backed by deeds. خير المقال ما صدقه الفعال. Oppressing the weak is the worst oppression. ظلم الضعيف أفحش الظلم. Knowledge is a noble legacy. العلم وراثة كريمة. And this one. The true worth of a man is measured by the good he does. قيمة كل امرئ ما يحسنه. Ali's exhortations are frequently rendered in exquisite metaphors. Listen to this one. Whosoever unsheathes the sword of treachery is slain by it. من سلى سيف البغي قتل به. Another one. There is no treasure richer than contentment. لا كنز أغنى من القناعة. Now, some of these figurative sayings give a glimpse into the natural landscape of the Arabian Peninsula. So, as in this one, a just leader is better than abundant rainfall. Another one, wisdom is the believer's lost camel. Camel, the animal, the camel, yeah? So wisdom is the believer's lost camel, and he should take it wherever he finds it because it belongs to him. Now, in the following piece, listen to Ali's warning about choosing one's friends very carefully. This saying is rendered in four parallelism-based lines. Beware of befriending a fool, for he wants to benefit you, but harms you instead. Beware of befriending a liar, for he brings near to you the distant and makes distant from you the near. Beware of befriending a miser, for he holds back from helping you when you most need him. And beware of befriending a depraved person, for he will sell you just to make a profit. Okay. So next to my second category for today, Imam Ali's teachings on the level of society and government and his advocacy of peace and pluralism. Ali explains the meaning of the term Islam as peace, and he links it with God's own name. In one text he says, God, this is the text, the quote of the text, God created all things knowing about them. He then selected what he wanted, picking out what he loved. What he loved was Islam. which he favored and made into a path for his servants. He derived its name from his name. For he is Salam, peace, and his religion is Islam. So this S-L-M, it's the same root that underpin both words Salam and Islam. In terms of society, many of Ali's sayings emphasize the sanctity of life and property. They condemn oppression and preach forgiveness, gentleness, and brotherhood. In a profound statement that applies to individuals as much as it does to groups and even states, he says, "How you wish to be treated should be the measure of how you treat others." In a line of poetry attributed to him, he says, "الناس من جهة التمثال أكفاء أبوهم آدم والأم حواء." All humans are peers and equals. Their father is Adam, their mother is Eve. Elsewhere he says, "Live among people in such a manner that while you live, they long for your company, and when you die, they weep over you." خَالِطُ النَّاسَ مُخَالَطَةً إِن مُتْتُم مَعَهَا بَكَوْا وَإِن عِشْتُمْ حَنُّوا إِلَيْكُمْ. In addition to his call for brotherhood among humans, Imam Ali expresses appreciation of all creatures of God, including birds and animals, and he exhorts his followers to be kind to them. In one text he says, "Be gentle with your horses and camels. Do not keep them standing while loaded. Do not make them drink with their bits in their mouth. Do not load them beyond their capacity." Now, on the plane of government and confirming his pluralistic conception, Ali urged his tax collectors to be gentle to all his subjects. In a letter to them, he wrote, that this is a quote from the letter, "Do not block people from their needs. Do not hinder them from seeking their necessities. Do not whip anyone for silver. Do not appropriate the property of any one of the people, whether they pray the prayer of Islam, i.e., whether they are Muslims, or whether they are protected through a covenant," referring to Jews and Christians. Ali's directions for just and kind rule applied equally to all members of society. A large proportion of the people in Ali's realms were Christians and Jews. And in Egypt, the majority were Copts, they were Coptic Christians. In many lands, the majority were non-Muslims. And even among the Muslims that lived in the realms that Ali ruled over, a large proportion were not his special followers. Yet, he made no distinction between them in terms of rights in the state. Here too, his directions for just and kind government applied equally. All were accorded safety of life, honor, and property. Indeed, justice for the weak and downtrodden is the hallmark of Ali's rule. His letters to governors are explicit in this regard. For example, in his letter of appointment for Malik al-Ashtar as governor of Egypt, Ali instructs him to be fair and compassionate to all his subjects in this famous line, and I quote, "They are either your brothers in faith, or your peers in humanity. Your peers in humanity. Imma akhun laka fi din aw nadhirun laka fil khalq." Regarding his own governing practice, Ali says, "I would prefer to sleep on a bed of thorns and be dragged in iron fetters rather than meeting God and his messenger having oppressed any of God's servants or having usurped any part of someone's property." Dirar's description of Ali to Muawiyah, and I cited a line from it earlier about his wisdom, highlights this aspect of Ali's exemplary character, the justice aspect, where Dirar says, and I would like to quote a few lines here from the Dirar passage. Ali, so this is Dirar, a companion of Ali, describing Ali to Muawiyah, who has taken over the caliphate after Ali has been killed. "Ali was foresighted and strong. When pronouncing judgment, he was discerning. When commanding, he was just. Knowledge gushed from his person. Wisdom spoke upon his tongue. He shied away from the ornaments of this world, taking solace in the lonely night. He wept copiously in prayer, thought deeply, and turned his hands one over the other, admonishing himself before admonishing others. He favored simple food and plain clothes. He lived among us as one of us, responding when asked and answering when questioned. But despite our intimacy, we would approach him with reverent awe, hesitating to call him out for a casual conversation. He respected the pious and was kind to the poor. The powerful did not dare presume upon a favorable ruling, and the weak never despaired of his justice. Now, Ali's call for peace and pluralism and his emphasis on justice rather than vengeance is even more remarkable when one considers them in the context of the hardships he faced in his life, some of which I have touched on briefly at the beginning of this talk. Moreover, Ali's inclusivism, his openness, and his tolerance are firmly anchored in his own strong conviction, in his own beliefs and righteousness. Pluralism is a modern concept, but we see it in action in the practice and teachings of Imam Ali. If we look through the compilations of Ali's words, the vision that emerges exhorts peaceful coexistence among communities, just governance with a role for people of all denominations, faiths, race, and gender, and respect and caring for all God's children. Now, to the third theme in Ali's teachings that I want to talk about today, namely, this world and the hereafter. Ali's orations and epistles urge an audience focused on their worldly lives to contemplate and prioritize the hereafter. Within the profusion of material, one observes, at least at first glance, a clear dichotomy in his treatment of the world. We find two radically contradictory positions articulated, one harshly castigating this world and the other staunchly defending it. By examining the backgrounds of his sermons, we see that the difference in characterization stems from the difference in context, and that the message is essentially the same. In all his discourses describing the world, whether the portrayal is positive or negative, Ali is urgently exhorting his followers to realize the transience of human life, to reject materialism, and to lead a godly life in preparation for the eternal life to come. He is urging them at all times to be mindful of the hereafter. Now, in the texts castigating the world, Ali emphasizes time and again that this world has no value. To point out its total insignificance, he compares it graphically in his sermons to objects familiar in the daily lives of people living in 7th century Arabia, objects that they would have held in utter contempt. So the world is compared in Ali's sermons to the following objects, yeah? A decaying carcass, jifa. Residual remnants of food scraps in the mouth, lumaba. And the Arabic is very economical. One word in Arabic, you have to open it out into a line of English. Shreds from the pods of a spiny acacia shrub, husalatul qarat. Wool fluff floating off a pair of shears as they clip, quradatul jalam. Bitter gallnuts, afsa maqira. A leaf being chomped in the mouth of a locust, وَرَقَةٌ فِي فَمِ جَرَادَةٍ تَقْدَمُهَا. The sneeze expectorate or fart of a goat, عَفْتَتْ hands. And finally, the bones of a pig in the hands of a leper, عِرَاقِ خِنْزِيرٍ فِي يَدِ مَجْزُومٍ. Now, one context for understanding the background of these harsh criticisms of the world is what we know from the sources about Ali's personality, his asceticism, especially in the last few years of his life, his strict ideas about right and wrong, his fairness with regard to distribution of treasury funds, and his crackdown on any hint of corruption among his governors. Following the conquests, the Muslim empire had grown large and rich, and in consequence, worldliness and bribery had spread among the inhabitants of Medina and Kufa. In contrast, Ali himself lived simply, and he urged his followers to do the same. The assertion about the world being worth less than bitter gallnuts was prompted by the following incident, and I just pick one. All of these little bitty quotes that I quoted have very, very interesting contexts. Yeah? Ali's governor in Basra was a man named Uthman ibn Hunayf, and he participated in an extravagant wedding celebration. Ali got to know about it, and he was not happy. Ibn Hunayf's rich hosts, according to Ali, routinely shunned the poor, and the sources of their wealth were highly dubious. Ali reprimanded the governor in a letter, urging Ibn Hunayf to follow his own, Ali's, example. And what was Ali's example? That he took from this world only the bare necessities, for it was worth less to him than bitter gallnuts. And I have used this word a few times. A gallnut is, for those of you who are not botanists, is a cancerous growth produced by certain plants to surround and kill any wasp eggs that are laid on its surface. Yeah, so it looks very ugly. And obviously a leaf is worth something because your camels and sheep can eat it. If it's surrounded or caked in by this gallnut, it renders it utterly useless. Yeah. So the idea is you don't want to collect them or hoard them. Why would you do that? Now, why use such strong language here and elsewhere? Why the relentless emphasis on the negative aspects of the world? The following report helps us understand why Ali so often and so lengthily castigated the world. The report says, and this is how it goes, Ali was participating in a funeral procession when he heard a man laugh. And he exclaimed, "We behave as though death were decreed for everyone other than ourselves, as though duties were incumbent upon everyone other than ourselves, as though people who die in front of our eyes are travelers who will soon return. We consign their bodies to the grave and then go on to consume their wealth, forgetting every counselor and shrugging off every tragedy." Now, Ali's sermons, with their harsh characterization of the world's ignoble character, attempt to shake up the complacent masses who are lulled by their base and mundane routines into dangerous oblivion of the inevitable end. The idea is to frighten them into taking heed while there is yet time. Here is another strongly worded warning. "This world is like a snake. It is soft to the touch, but its venom is lethal. Inna mathal ad-dunya mathal al-hayya layyin massuha qatilun sammuha." The foolish lad rushes towards it, and the intelligent man is wary of it. "Turn away from its attractions, for it will be with you for only a very short time. Shrug off its cares, for you will soon depart from it. When you are most comfortable in it, beware of it the most." Now, although Ali's condemnation of the world appears total, it is in fact qualified and a means to an end. The particular contexts of these orations show that the world, when denounced in his orations, is not to be taken as an absolute term. Rather, the criticism is directed to the base aspects of the world, including money, power, fame, particularly when they distract from the hereafter, or worse, when they are obtained illegally and incur reprisals in the hereafter. In startling contrast to Ali's censorious characterization of the world in most of his sermons, in just a few pieces attributed to him, we see a vigorous defense of the world, even praise. One widely cited example is a sharp oration delivered to a group of men from his own army late in the night, immediately following the Battle of the Camel. When he heard, when Ali overheard a man castigating the world, he stood up and said this in the following oration, and I quote to you a piece from it. O you who reproach the world while being so willingly deceived by her deceptions and tricked by her falsehoods, do you choose to be deceived by her yet censure her? Should you be accusing her or should she be accusing you? When did she lure you or deceive? Was it by her destruction of your father and grandfather and great-grandfather through decay? Or by her consigning your mother and grandmother and great-grandmother to the earth? How carefully did your palms tend them? How tenderly did your hands nurse them? Hoping against hope for a cure, begging physician after physician for a medicament. On that fateful morning, your medicines were not enough. Your weeping did not help, and your apprehension was of no benefit. Your appeal remained unanswered. And although you applied all your strength, you could not push away death. By this, the world warned you of your own approaching end. She illustrated by their death your own. Indeed, this world is a house of truth for whomsoever stays true to her. It is a house of well-being for whomsoever understands her. A house of riches for whomsoever gathers her provisions. A house of counsel for whomsoever takes her advice. This world is a mosque for God's loved ones, a place where God's angels pray, where God's revelation alights, where God's saints transact, earning his mercy and profiting paradise. This is the end of the quote. It goes on, but I will stop here. By censuring the world, Ali's companions were presumably shifting blame for their own shortcomings. Ali reminded his companions that the world is neither good nor bad in and of itself, but that both the good and bad of this world are with reference to its people. We should not reproach the world for our own defects. It is we who choose our path. We make of the world what we will. We use it or abuse it as we will. In the final piece that I want to quote for you today, in his letter to his second governor in Egypt, Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr, and to the Egyptians, the letter is addressed both to Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr, who is sent as a governor, and to the Egyptians as large. So in this letter, Ali explicitly praises good living as long as it is accompanied by godliness. Moving away from his usual strong criticisms of worldly pleasures, he empties this piece of the slightest whiff of asceticism. And this is the quote that I read for you. You should know, O servants of God, that the pious partake of the joys of this world and those of the next. They share the world with the worldly, but the worldly do not share the hereafter with them. In this world, the pious reside in the most splendid of residences and consume the finest of delicacies. سَكَنُوا الدُّنْيَا بِأَفْضَلِ مَا سُكِنَتْ وَأَكَلُوهَا بِأَفْضَلِ مَا أُكِلَتْ. They possess the sumptuous comforts of the wealthy and partake of the lavish luxuries of the mighty. Yet, when they depart, they leave with full provisions and a large profit. ثُمَّ انْقَلَبُوا عَنْهَا بِالزَّادِ الْمُبَلِّغِ وَالْمَتْجَرِ الرَّابِحِ. They enjoy the pleasures of this world without becoming immersed in worldliness, happy in the certain knowledge that they will be God's neighbors in the next. No prayer rejected, no pleasure withheld. In this epistle, Ali explains that while living a full and engaged life in this world, you should also use your time to prepare fully for the next. You should be happy in this world and enjoy its delights to the fullest, yet at the same time, you should always bear in mind, not pessimistically, but realistically, the imminent arrival of death. When Ali is censuring the world, he is criticizing certain aspects of human nature that are base. He is addressing an audience whose members are immersed in worldliness at the expense of the hereafter. Ali's response to their gross materialism is to point out the insignificance of the world and its ultimate destruction. When he is defending this world, on the other hand, he is addressing an audience whose members are implicitly disclaiming responsibility for their own immorality by blaming the world. Ali's response to their disclaimer is to point out to them that the world is merely an arena for performing one's actions, and the choice as to how we use the world, for good or for bad ends, is entirely ours. That brings me to the end of my talk. In my summary presentation, I have attempted to describe some of Imam Ali's teachings on personal ethics, government and society, and mindfulness of the hereafter. I hope I leave you with appreciation for his rich Islamic legacy and his universal values. Thank you.